with you. It's been a while since I have been here. So there are good familiar faces that I see, and there are definitely some faces that I do not recognize, and so it's nice to meet you. My name is Lee Hinkle. I'm the pastor there at Fremantle Church, which is a WPC church plant looking to move into being a fully constituted church, hopefully within the next year. And so we're excited to be a part of this particular group of churches gathered together to do kingdom work. I am married. My wife is there leading worship today, singing at Fremantle Church, and I have five children. My son Braden, many of you know, is 25. He is back in the States and married, and we hope that he moves back here at some point. And then I have a daughter, Madison, 21. Some of you might know her as well. Reagan, who is 17, you might know her from doing Brookton things. And then Georgia, who is 14, and Rose, who is 11. And so they are all back there. And so it is good to be with you today. If I were to ask you a question of what is a synonym for the word faith, what words would you come up with, a synonym for the word faith? That means similar, by the way, a similar word to faith. Huh? Hope, yep, that's a good one.
Trust.
Yeah. Belief, yeah, excellent. All right, what if I said an antonym, an opposite of the word faith?
Disbelief.
Mistrust.
Yeah.
Fear. How about doubt? Yeah. I think today in our world and where we sometimes walk, we step into places of fear and doubt. I mean, if we look around the world today, we recognize that there are things that we can't trust. There are things that we maybe have put our hope in that have failed us. We might even look and say, there is places that I doubt what people are saying to me. There are things that have come into our lives that have caused us to go, I thought my life was going this direction, and now it's not. What could I possibly put my faith in? Because I thought that was the thing. In this particular encounter with the resurrected Jesus, we see Jesus step in to address how we deal with fear and doubt. We recognize that he walks into this place as the resurrected one, encountering his disciples, those who have been most intimately involved with his ministry. And he recognizes within them, because they're basically shouting it by their actions, we have fear and we have doubt. And so as we step into this, hopefully what we will find is our encounter with the resurrected Christ gives us the answers of how we engage in fear and doubt. They are normal things for us to experience. It's not sinful for us to have them run into our hearts, but we don't want to let them stay there, because then they can lead us to a place of ultimate destruction. So let's look at this first place where Jesus comes in and he encounters this beautiful narrative that John has written for us to know and to trust. He shows up and we recognize that fear is present. Why? Because even though Peter has seen the resurrected Jesus, he comes back to the 12 or the 10 at this point, because Thomas isn't there and Judas is left. And he says, guys, it's true. Let's shut the doors and lock it. Right? Because the doors are locked. Why? Because they're fearful for their lives. They're afraid that the Jews are going to have gone and recognized that something has happened. And so before this gets out anywhere, we need to make sure those who would be the first to tell people about it are taken care of. It's not an unjustifiable fear. They were the ones that were so closely aligned and recognized with Jesus. So if the ruling authorities don't want people to know about this, so it's not that they're doubting maybe that Jesus is raised from the dead, right? I think sometimes we think that's where that's coming from. But it's that if this is true, then people, then the ruling authorities aren't going to want to know, have people know about it. So let's take care of those who will talk about it the most. And so they've locked the doors. And so Jesus shows up, and their hearts are filled with fear. And the first thing that the resurrected Christ says to them is, "Peace be to you." It's a good thing it was Jesus, because had it been me, I would have said, "What's wrong with you guys? Don't you know you've seen the resurrected Jesus? Shouldn't you feel pretty powerful that you are connected to the one who has overcome death?" But that's not what Jesus does. Jesus comes in and he recognizes that they are in fear and says, "Peace be to you." Peace. Shalom is the Hebrew. Wholeness, completeness, reordering the way that it's supposed to be. Your life has gone awry. You feel like things are lost. You don't know what to do next. Peace to you. And they begin to celebrate. They begin to go, "Yes, the Lord is here. That's awesome. He's present." And yet Jesus again says to them, "Peace be to you." I think it's interesting that he does this, that he says it once, they celebrate, and he says it again. It's almost as if he knows that they are experiencing an exhilaration of excitement because they're seeing Jesus, and that it is not sustainable if it's only based on their experiencing it. Jesus wants them to know that this peace is not momentary, that this peace is not just because you are experiencing my presence at this moment, this excitement of seeing me coming through a locked door, but that it is ongoing and everlasting. So let me remind you real quickly, dear disciples, no, peace be to you. He's almost personifying it. In fact, he does. How do we know that? Because at that very moment, after he says, "Peace be to you," he gives them a purpose. And he gives them the Holy Spirit. He says, "I want this peace to be sustainable, not based on an experience that you're having at this moment, but I want it sustainable, resting in me, because I'm going to empower you to go do what God sent me to do." So he looks at them and he says, "Receive the Holy Spirit." He breathes on them. "The Father has sent me, and I am sending you." So in this place of fear, this place of undoing that we might be experiencing, when we see the resurrected Christ, he is the one that comes to bring us wholeness, but not just wholeness for our own experience, but wholeness so that we can then go out. That we can move forward and we can proclaim that there is forgiveness of sins. That there is a release from bondage. That there is a place of new life. And we don't have to do it by ourselves. We've been empowered and received the Holy Spirit. Christ living in us and through us. Joined together with all of those who are believers. So that we're not alone when we face those things that would bring us fear. The reality is, fear comes from a lack of control. A place where we think we've got it figured out, that life has moved in this direction and that's the way it should go. But it now doesn't, and it shows us that we don't have control over every area of our lives. It could be a diagnosis. It could be a lost job. It could be fractured relationships. It could be any number of things. But for one moment, at some place, we thought, "I've got my life together. I've got everything figured out. I can get from A to B to Z." And something comes out and goes, "Actually, you're doing a numerical chart. You need to go from 1 to 100. And Jesus comes into that place because when we lose control, fear creeps in. So how is Jesus the one who's able to say, "Peace be to you"? Because he's the one who ultimately controls the universe. And yet he gave up all control to be on the cross. The one who strings everything together and holds the very universe in his hand so it doesn't spin out of control, gave up control to be crucified so that we can have control in him. Not us holding on to it, but knowing and trusting and having faith that no matter what happens, no matter what takes place, by Holy Spirit continuing to testify to us that we know God is walking in a purposeful way with us. Now, Thomas wasn't there. Not present with them. And they go to Thomas. And let me just say, Thomas here, right in this passage, sounds like so many celebrity Christians who have deconverted. He sounds like so many who have had experiences with Jesus, but have decided they don't meet the expectation that they have for the resurrected one. And let's not just put it out there. Some of us also. You see, because doubt comes from missed expectations. We think this is the way it should be. This is our expectation of how things should happen. And when our expectations aren't met, whether it be from the church or whether it be from individuals or whether it be from how we've interpreted the Bible, whatever it might be, our expectation. And so we then begin to doubt whether or not the thing that we've put our faith in is real. Because our expectation was misaligned. See, here's what happens. They come to him and they say, "Hey, Jesus is raised from the dead. He is alive. He has blown the whole... We are given purpose. We have the things to do. By the way, could you lock the door?" What? I mean, that's generous for us. I think John is generous for us to recognize that they locked the door again. I mean, Jesus breathed on them. Right? Like, and they're still like, just to be safe. Right? That's good for us to know that there's these places of work that still needs to be done in our hearts. That yes, while we trust and have assurance and we walk with the resurrected Christ, there are things that will bump into us that cause us to go, "Can we just lock the door for just a little bit?" And Jesus shows up in that place, and what does he say? "Peace be to you. Peace be to you." And then he looks at Thomas. And he says very quickly to him, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Place your hand in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Now, if you're like me, and in many ways I hope that you're not, when you hear Jesus saying those words, you might hear them as a parent, as my dad, when I've done something wrong. Or maybe you hear them as a teacher who's correcting a classroom. We hear it and it's almost like, "Would you stop disbelieving and just believe?" I don't think that's what Jesus says there. I don't think that's his tone. Why? Well, because just above it he says, "Peace be to you." So someone who is bringing ultimate peace, someone who is saying, "I want to bring comfort to you in your fear," cannot turn around and go, "And you are terrible at this." He says, "Stop disbelieving. Thomas, know that I am the resurrected one. Thomas, know that my great love for you brings forth in the fact that I want you to have an experiential. I want you to have a tangible. I want you to put your hands here so that you can know and believe beyond a shadow of doubt that I am the resurrected Christ. You see, we sometimes set our expectations of Jesus, and let me be honest, the church often does a poor job at exemplifying Jesus. And so there's reason for people who have expectations that it should be a certain way to go, ooh, that doesn't look about right. But their doubt comes from a misalignment of their expectations and not a seeing clearly who Jesus is. The benefit that we have in the resurrected Christ is that he comes to us where we're at. He doesn't come into Thomas and say, you should believe because I said you should believe. He comes where Thomas is at. How's he able to do that? Because he is the one who always comes where we're at. And ultimately did that, what? By becoming man and going to the cross. It says all of your expectations are wrapped up in something that you actually don't know. Let me show you what salvation looks like. Let me show you what the King of the universe looks like. He is the one who sacrifices and brings steadfast love. And so, Thomas, what does he do when he experiences the resurrected Christ in this way? Does he reach out and put his hands there? Some commentaries say no. A few say yes. I say we don't know. It doesn't tell us what he does. What we do know is that he worships. Because he says, my Lord and my God. There is no other one I want to serve. There is no other one, and that you are the Creator, the one who is high and holy. That he worships, that his expectations get shifted to the place of seeing Jesus for who he is. Now, if you were to push me, I would say I doubt that he put his hands there. Because when Jesus comes to us, it causes us to know who we are and to know who he is so that we will worship him. And in worshiping him, it realigns our expectations of who he is so that when doubt creeps in because some thing over here didn't go according to plan, we can see Jesus above it and below it, beside it and beyond it, and know that he will work it good for his good pleasure to those who love him. Ultimately, we know this, and John tells us this in his letter, that perfect love drives out fear. Perfect love, I would say, drives out doubt. That it is the love of God who comes through Jesus that brings the way for us to have the substitute to our need for control and our false expectations. He takes them and puts them aside. He takes them and he fulfills them so that we can have assurance and hope in the steadfast love of God. And here is the promise for us in this passage. This engagement that Jesus has with the 11. He says, oh, you have believed, or have you believed, or it's because you have seen me that you believe. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. We didn't get the opportunity to see the tangible Jesus. Right? The flesh and blood Jesus, the hair growing Jesus, the eating Jesus, the walking about us Jesus. But we believe. What we get is the beautiful body of Jesus, the cosmic Christ showing forth within his particular people. And what a blessing it is that in this we then know and believe that he is the one who has conquered all of our fear and doubt. And we have others to remind us and encourage us and to walk with us when we say, can we just lock the door for a minute? And they'll remind us Jesus is about to show up. Let me pray.